Today is Monday, June 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The leaders of the G7 countries wrap up their meeting in Britain.
How we act and whether we pull together as democracies is going to determine whether our grandkids look back 15 years from now and say, did they step up?
Plus, the votes are in and Israel has a new government by the slimmest of margins. And we sit down with a Congolese musical legend to discuss music today. We'll have these stories and more next. G7 leaders have wrapped up their summit in Carbis Bay, England, pledging more than 1 billion COVID-19 vaccine doses to poorer nations and calling out China on several issues. Following the summit, U.S. President Joe Biden said to reporters the democracies were in a contest with autocratic governments to see who could respond the best and the fastest to challenges in the 21st century.
How we act and whether we pull together as democracies is going to determine whether our grandkids look back 15 years from now and say, did they step up? Are democracies as relevant and as powerful as they have been?
VOA White House correspondent Patsy Wiedekuswara is traveling with the president and spoke to me about Biden's first international summit from Brussels, Belgium, where Biden next will meet with NATO leaders.
So the focus was supposed to be about COVID, and the leaders did come out with a statement, which is what they call the Carbis Bay Declaration. This is a pledge to end the pandemic and prepare for future ones, as well as reinvigorate the economy that's just battered by COVID all throughout the world. Of course, there's a big 1 billion doses of donations of vaccines, 500 million of which coming from the U.S., 100 coming from the U.K., and the rest coming in from the rest of the G7 countries, some in the form of actual vaccine doses and others in the form of support for COVAX. This is the U.N. mechanism for vaccine sharing. Now, activists are saying that is not enough. We need at least 11 billion of doses of vaccines to vaccinate the world, enough to get to herd immunity. So they're pushing for G7 countries to do more, including to waive patents for vaccines at the World Trade Organization. Now, the leaders did not want to do this. In their communique, they're saying that they want to ramp up production by means of licensing and technology sharing, but not essentially giving up the recipes for vaccines so that developing countries can produce their own. So that's on COVID. The other big thing was, of course, the statement on climate change. The rich nations agree that they will fulfill their pledge of $100 billion in the form of climate financing. This is money to help developing nations cope with climate change and reduce their greenhouse gases emissions. And even though those two were the big focus, of course, what's the underlining in all of this is China and Russia. There was a statement from the G7 communique that mentioned China and Russia several times. Particularly for China, it's calling Beijing out for its use of forced labor in Xinjiang towards ethnic minorities, Uyghur ethnic minorities, and other ethnic minorities, as well as unfair trade practices. And what the leaders also wanted to offer was an alternative to the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative. This is, of course, what you know is the infrastructure financing that is central to Beijing's foreign policy. Now, what the G7 leaders want to offer is what they call Build Back Better World, or the acronym B3W. And that's meant to be a financing structure to help developing countries with their infrastructure project. However, it is still unclear the timeline, the size, and the scope of the financing. So it's actually still very nascent, Steve.
Patsy, you're now in Brussels, where Biden now turns his attention to NATO and meeting with the leaders there. What's on his docket for Monday?
So he's going to be joining his fellow NATO leaders to talk about security concerns. Russia will definitely be an issue. China as well. Cybersecurity, ransomware, just the whole gamut. And again, this is part of the big design from U.S. President Joe Biden coming into first the U.K. at the G7 summit, and then the NATO summit on Monday, and then the EU summit on Tuesday, just basically shoring up all the allies in all those issues that I mentioned, global security, climate change, ransomware, how to deal with security issues, hotspots around the world, in order to have just really a lot of strength and a lot of ally support as he meets with President Vladimir Putin on Wednesday.
Speaking of that upcoming meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin, I understand the conversations are still ongoing with Moscow as to how that summit between Biden and Putin will take place. What can you tell us?
Yes, that's correct. So until the last minute, the White House team continues to negotiate the format of both the meeting as well as the press conference afterwards. So what we know so far from the White House is that the leaders will have two bilateral meetings. The first one, a smaller version where it's just the two presidents, interpreters, possibly a small number of staff. And then the second one will be the extended bilateral. After that, the White House just said that they will only be having one press conference. As you said, there was talks of having both of the leaders coming out together to speak to the press. President Biden was asked about this by a reporter at his press conference at the G7. Why don't you have a joint press conference so that you can show the world how both of you feel about what you discuss? And President Biden essentially said that, that's not the way we do it. It doesn't matter what President Putin wants to say, but definitely we'll have an account of how the meetings went.
VOA White House correspondent Patsy Wiedekuswara. With a single vote in the Israeli Knesset, Naftali Bennett has become the country's new prime minister, ousting Benjamin Netanyahu from the position that he's held for the past 12 years. I spoke with reporter Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem following the 60-59 vote and saw Israel form a new government after four elections in 2 years.
So what happened today, basically, is that the new government squeaked through. Naftali Bennett, who actually his party only has six seats out of a total of 120. The largest opposition party was actually Yesh Atid, which is headed by a former television personality named Yair Lapid. But in order to form a coalition, Lapid agreed that he would be alternative prime minister and Bennett would go first. So basically what happened is that the government is this combination of eight different parties from the right wing to the center to the left wing, and they managed to cobble together a majority of one seat. And that, according to Israeli law, is enough for there to be a new government. And so we saw a speech by Naftali Bennett that was repeatedly interrupted with people in the Likud and Netanyahu's party calling him a criminal and a liar. People were actually, some of the Knesset members were actually thrown out of the Knesset. We saw a speech by Netanyahu, a very angry speech in which he accused Bennett of being fake right and promised that this government wouldn't last and he would be back. Then there was the vote. And then we saw actually the Netanyahu and the Likud members leave, get up and move their seats, and Bennett and his government take the seats at the cabinet table. And they were then sworn in to the government. And as of, a few minutes ago, Israel has a new government. It's 36th government. And Bennett, by the way, is the second youngest prime minister. He's 49. Netanyahu was 46 the first time he became prime minister. And it's also the first time that Israel is headed by an observant Jew. If you look, Naftali Bennett wears a small yarmulke or skullcap.
Linda, you mentioned the fiery speech by former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. I was wondering if you could kind of go into some details about what's next for him, since he has vowed to stay on as the head of the Likud party.
Yes, in the past, often if somebody has led their party to defeat, they kind of see that as a sign and have resigned and kind of paved the way for somebody new to come in. Netanyahu insists that he's not going to do that. He is going to remain as the opposition leader, and I think he's going to try to make the new government's life as difficult as possible. It's important to remember that Netanyahu is also on trial in three separate corruption cases. That trial's probably going to take several years. But there's also some speculation that this government, which the only thing the parties committed to it all share is that they wanted to get rid of Netanyahu. And now that that's happened, it's possible that, you know, once it gets to making decisions, the government won't be able to maintain itself and it will dissolve and there could be another election.
Linda Gradstein spoke to me from Jerusalem. This weekend on VOA's Encounter radio program, host Carol Castiel spoke with two analysts about Israel's new government. Lucy Kirchner-Ellenbogen, director of the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict Program at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and Nathan Sachs, director of the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. They discussed the makeup of Israel's new administration and if many parties within the new coalition can agree on vital internal and external policies, as well as manage to govern. In this special Encounter Extra, Nathan Sachs discusses how the new government may deal with Arab relations.
And so, in short, yes, this government will have to deal with the Palestinian issue. That will be very difficult and complicated, especially when it touches on issues such as Jerusalem and policing in Jerusalem and the settlements. But I do not think it will find itself really confronting the question of the long-term borders and citizenry of Israel. Is it one state, two, three, or whatever? And I'll add one more point. Since really these questions of on the ground and conflict management will become crucial, unfortunately, I wish there was chance for conflict resolution, but I do not judge it to be the case. That means that some of the ministers, for example, the new minister for internal security, Omer Bar-Lev, will be very important. He comes from Labor, from the left. He's an experienced man with a military background, and in fact, will probably be much more responsible and able and well-intentioned than the current minister of internal security, who was selected for the job mostly because of his loyalty to Benjamin Netanyahu. And so some subtle changes like that, for example, the appointment of someone I think very able and qualified like Omer Bar-Lev, could actually be much more important than the ideological differences between Naftali Bennett and Yair Lapid, who disagree, but both agree that it's completely irrelevant right now.
And what about the role of Arab countries, particularly our allies like Jordan and Egypt? Can they make a difference? How will they interact with the new coalition in Israel? And what about the so-called countries of the Abraham Accords? To what extent can they, you know, exert any type of positive influence toward at least calm, if not a way toward a solution?
I think for many countries around the world, but in particular for countries like Jordan, there will be a bit of a difference in how they relate to different parts of the government. They will find solace in the fact that the foreign minister is in charge of foreign affairs, and so they will therefore deal with the foreign minister, Yair Lapid. They'll probably have less appetite to dealing with Prime Minister Naftali Bennett. There's also a president of Israel, Yitzhak Herzog, who used to be the leader of the Labor Party from the left. That's another person that Jordan, for example, might find it quite easy to deal with. Not that they will necessarily boycott Naftali Bennett, but I think they will find the ways to deal, especially with Lapid and perhaps with Gantz, who has a lot of authority as Minister of Defense. The Abraham Accords in particular relate to the United Arab Emirates. They're really the crucial one there. And for them, they find themselves in a situation where their partner was Netanyahu, but their interests really were about Israel and not about Netanyahu. So they would like to probably continue with this. And I don't think it matters to them terribly who's in charge in Israel. They are extremely antagonistic towards Hamas, but they're also not in good relations with the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah, the big rival of Hamas. And so they find themselves actually quite outside the equation in most instances, although many people always think of them as a potential source of finances, of course. One country that can have a lot of influence and is already exerting some of it is Egypt. Egypt is in a rather unique place. It borders the Gaza Strip, of course. So the blockade of the Gaza Strip is really an Israeli-Egyptian blockade. And Egypt, unlike almost any one of the key actors, has relations to Hamas. It speaks directly and very frequently to Hamas through security channels. It also has cordial relations with the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah, which is ideologically closer to. It, of course, has peaceful and quite close relations to Israel at the elite and security level, and, of course, relates to most other actors. In that sense, especially as it relates to Gaza, Egypt can be extremely important. And I'll add one more thing, which is the thawing in the crisis in the Gulf between the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council countries, and especially between Saudi Arabia and Qatar, less so UAE and Qatar, has meant that now Qatar and Egypt have thawed their relations as well. This matters because Qatar, which tends to be more favorable towards Muslim Brotherhood organizations, has a closer relation to Hamas than most other actors, is perhaps the closest Arab country to Hamas. And if they and the Egyptians can and cooperate more than in the past, there may be a path to some kind of modus vivendi between Israel and Hamas via the Egyptians and with support of the Qataris. I want to qualify that. We're not talking about peace. Hamas is not interested in peace, ideologically opposed to it. But we may be talking about a better modus vivendi, and that would be extremely important because there are 2 million people in Gaza living in terrible conditions as a result of the blockade and the continued fighting between Hamas and Israel. And even if small changes in the reality can be produced, that would be extremely important for the 2 million people living in the worst conditions in this whole scenario.
That was the director of the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, Nathan Sachs, speaking with VOA Encounters host Carol Castiel. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. At least 13 people were killed and several more were wounded in 2 separate artillery attacks on the northern Syrian town of Afrin on Saturday. That's according to local media sources speaking to Reuters and Turkey's government. Reuters reporter Lauren Anthony has more.
The first attack struck a residential area. Shortly afterwards, the second hit the Al-Shifa hospital. Turkey has a large military presence in the northern Syrian area. It said the missile attack was launched by the Syrian Kurdish YPG militia, though the Syrian Democratic Forces, a US-backed militia force spearheaded by the YPG, said it was not responsible. The governor's office in Turkey's Hatay province, bordering Afrin, said it was investigating the incident and that missiles were fired from the Tel Rifat area controlled by the Syrian government.
Reuters' Lauren Anthony. Concerns about the safety of the COVID-19 vaccine are common, especially when it comes to inoculating very young children. A new study suggests that some mothers may be passing along antibodies to their infants. VOA's Dilge Timochin has the details.
Dora is 6 months old. His mother, Nagihan Dede, was visiting her family in Turkey when she found out she was pregnant with her son. Then the coronavirus pandemic broke out and she was stranded in Istanbul for months.
We never got out. I just went to see my doctors because we didn't know what the disease was.
She returned to the U.S., and in October, 5 months after returning from Turkey, Dora was born. Within weeks, the U.S. began its vaccine campaign, and Dede, who was breastfeeding, began looking into whether the vaccines were safe for her and her child.
I consulted my doctor, and my doctor told me that I also passed the vaccine benefits to my child through breastfeeding, and that it was protecting him as well.
A joint study by Harvard University and Massachusetts General Hospital suggests mothers are passing on COVID-19 antibodies to their babies. The study included 131 women, 84 of them pregnant, 31 breastfeeding, and 16 neither pregnant nor breastfeeding. The research found that vaccine antibodies passed on to the babies before and after birth through the umbilical cord or breast milk.
Individuals that has been vaccinated and they are breastfeeding, they provide a more robust immune protective response to the infant versus if you've been naturally infected with COVID-19.
Dr. Sira Madad is an infectious diseases expert featured on a Netflix documentary called Pandemic, How to Prevent an Outbreak. She is also a breastfeeding mother.
While I was breastfeeding my now one-year-old, I actually decided months ago that I would pump and give the breast milk to my 5- and 7-year-old in their milk just to pass on those antibodies and that protective benefits.
Some parents worry that the breast milk of a vaccinated mother can be harmful to the baby. But according to the CDC, these vaccines are not believed to be a risk to lactating people or their breastfeeding babies. And the U.S. Health Agency says reports show antibodies in the breast milk may help protect babies, although more data is needed to determine what protections these antibodies may provide.
So you're not going to find the virus in the breast milk. You're going to find the antibodies, the protective antibodies instead. And so it's important just to understand how the mechanism and the biological plausibility of, you know, any dangerous pose, and there is no dangerous pose in that regard.
Doctors hope this is good news for mothers like Nagihan Dede, who want to ensure they and their children are protected from the virus. Dilge Timochin, VOA News, Washington.
United Nations agencies are warning that thousands of children in northern Ethiopia's Tigray province risk dying from starvation and malnutrition-related illnesses because aid agencies can't reach the region with humanitarian aid. Lisa Schlein takes it from here.
Conflict-ridden Tigray remains off-limits to United Nations and private aid agencies, despite Ethiopian government promises they would have unfettered access to the region. UNICEF spokesman James Elder says the region is on the brink of famine, adding that without immediate massive assistance, Tigray will face a crisis not seen in a decade.
We are seeing more and more young children and babies slide dangerously close to sickness and potential death from malnutrition. So we've rung alarm bells, and here we are now. We now have, you know, the largest number of people classified as food insecure in a decade since Somalia. And as I say, that very real risks the deaths of tens of thousands of children.
An estimated 250,000 people died in the devastating 2010-2011 Somali famine, more than half of them children under the age of five. The United Nations says more than 350,000 people in Tigray are on the verge of famine. It warns an estimated 33,000 severely malnourished children in inaccessible areas are at high risk of death. The World Health Organization reports its teams and mobile health clinics are ready to go into Tigray and administer care, but have been turned away by the warring parties. WHO spokeswoman Margaret Harris says access to the region is key to tackling what she calls a public health emergency.
Malnourished children are more likely to contract any of the infectious diseases and die of it, such as pneumonia, diarrhea, malaria, and measles. Malaria and malnutrition is a lethal combination. So we're over 350 severe acute malnutrition cases among children under 5 years of age last week only. That was just last week, 18 of them with complications.
Harris says WHO is kicking off a cholera vaccination campaign Saturday as the disease thrives during the rainy season, which begins this month. She says 4,000 people will be inoculated as a preventive measure, as Tigray is known as a place with outbreaks in the past. However, she adds, the campaign's success requires safe access by health workers. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. An Aboriginal mother in Australia will take a human rights claim over her son's death in custody to the United Nations. Phil Mercer reports that David Dungay Jr. died after being restrained by five prison officers in a prison cell in 2015.
"I can't breathe" were among the last words spoken by David Dungay Jr. Video shown at an Australian inquiry into his death 6 years ago documented his final moments. He was struggling to breathe as he was held face down by a group of guards at Sydney's Long Bay Jail and injected with a sedative. The 26-year-old Indigenous man was being restrained by officers trying to stop him from eating biscuits because of fears he could fall into a diabetic coma. The inquest later found that none of the guards should face disciplinary action. No criminal charges have ever been filed over Dungay's death. His mother, Letona Dungay, and a team of high-profile lawyers have argued Australia violated her son's human rights and failed to protect his life. Having campaigned vociferously in Australia, they're taking their case to the United Nations, filing a complaint with its Human Rights Commission. Letona Dungay says the UN must be told about a crisis in Australia's criminal justice system.
"I will not stop until I get justice for my son. My heart bleeds for him every day. The so-called justice system in my country, Australia, has failed. Failed me, my son, my family and my people. I'm going to keep fighting until we live in the country where Black Lives Matter."
Letona Dungay's legal team is also seeking to put pressure on the government in Canberra over its record on Indigenous deaths in custody. Aboriginal Australians are among the most incarcerated people in the world. They make up about 3% of Australia's population, but almost a third of prison inmates. While Indigenous prisoners don't die at a greater rate than non-Aboriginal people in custody, they are vastly overrepresented in the criminal justice system. Since a historic inquiry into Aboriginal deaths in custody in 1991, at least 474 Indigenous people have died behind bars. Australia's Attorney General's Department has said that 78% of the Royal Commission's 339 recommendations had been fully or mostly implemented. However, those statistics are disputed by some Aboriginal organisations. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And finally, veteran musician and producer Wurrasun has been a seminal figure in Congolese music since the early 1980s. VOA ethnomusicologist and host of Music Time in Africa, Heather Maxwell, joins him in this virtual conversation to talk about his music today and its role in developing undiscovered Congolese talent.
Hello, Wurrasun. It is nice to see you. So what are you doing in the United States?
I'm in the United States because I have my family here, and then I also went to Dallas. A friend of mine invited me to a wedding. That is the main reason why I'm here.
Was it difficult to travel under COVID restrictions?
It was easy because before traveling, I had to take a test, and now I took my test, and without that, I couldn't travel.
Wurrasun, this is your band, Wenge Musica Maison Mère, right?
Yeah, it's my band, Wenge Musica Maison Mère. I'm the one that created it, and it's my band.
Since, like, 1997, is it?
Since then, I work with my band. People come and leave, and today I still continue to recruit people that come in my band to play with me, and they come and they go.
What are you singing about in this song? What is Formidable?
I'm singing about everything that makes you happy. And when you see my clip, you can tell that everything inside is formidable. Formidable the dance, formidable the people inside. I'm talking about just the world being formidable and the joy of dancing.
Well, one thing that is formidable that I hear is your voice.
Thank you so much. It's my own voice, as you can see. I don't force anything. I just sing naturally. So thank you so much for the compliment.
Jamaica also is very talented. I noticed that when he comes in near the middle of the song, the rhythm and the tempo change. Is that his signature?
Is that something different? Yeah, you are right. Jamaica is very talented. But most of what he is doing in the clip, as you see, is the orientation that I give to them. And most of them just come and then they don't know exactly what to do. But it's about what exactly I want to show with his talent that I put something on him to do something. So I'm going to suggest you, if you would like, to take a look on one of my clips called Block Cardina. There is a young boy over there. He's playing the guitar. I'm sure you're going to like it. You're going to like it, and we're going to see how much I can use talent to make them give the best of them.
What does this gesture mean?
As you said, I'm a showman, so the move just you talk about is just, you know, I'm doing stuff to make people dance and then to motivate people. It's just, you know, it's what I do. As a showman, you have to do stuff to make people dance, and then that's all I do. If you come to my concert, you see how much I can motivate people. Even those that don't want to dance, they can dance if I do that.
Okay, well, Ngaima Makanda Wurrasun, King of the Forest. Thank you. you so much for joining me today and taking the time out from your family time here in the U.S. I really enjoyed speaking with you, and I'm sure our audiences are really happy to.
Hey, Dave, Roma, thank you. This is very delicious, very nice. Roma, je vous aime.
Thank you.
Salon op air na London.
And that's going to do it for us today. Thank you so much for listening to VOA's International Edition. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.